John Batts with Troy Senek, a man of iron. The turbulent life and improbable presidency of Grover Cleveland. He leaves office in the election of 1896, a man whom Cleveland celebrates, McKinley, becomes president of the United States. Teddy Roosevelt is in the future now. Teddy Roosevelt doesn't become vice president until the second term for McKinley. Cleveland and Frances, with their two children, I believe, at this point, maybe more, leave Washington, and they move to Princeton, New Jersey. And the president becomes involved with Princeton University at the time that a young professor is startling everybody with his genius and drive, named Woodrow Wilson. What do we know about the relationship between Wilson, the future president, and Grover Cleveland, the former president?
They have a relationship that I think we can describe as friendly without necessarily being friends. Wilson, in his capacity as a scholar, had actually been quite positive on Cleveland, probably the best contemporary record of the Cleveland presidency and contemporary analysis was written by Woodrow Wilson in The Atlantic. Wilson praises Cleveland in his post-presidency as roughly the kind of president the founders probably had in mind. And what he meant by that is independent, seeing himself as an independent power center from the Congress and a check on Congress. But there is a bit of conflict in the future here, because Wilson will become the president of Princeton. Cleveland is eventually on the board. And the event that actually precipitates Wilson leaving academia and going into politics is what seems to us a very small board dispute over the proper location of the graduate campus then to be built at Princeton. Wilson and Cleveland are on opposite sides of this question. We don't have a lot of closed-door records of what happened, but we know that there were some fairly icy exchanges, most of the ice coming from the Wilson side. And so in a weird way, Grover Cleveland is partially responsible for the events that precipitate Woodrow Wilson, the politician, and following that, Woodrow Wilson, the president of the United States.
And Grover Cleveland and Teddy Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt becomes his accidency is how he's called, because McKinley is assassinated in Buffalo in 1901, and Roosevelt becomes president immediately. Did he have correspondence with Grover Cleveland? Did they meet in a formal affairs? Did they have a relationship?
Yeah, there are instances of Cleveland and Roosevelt writing back and forth. Cleveland at one point offering to help Roosevelt in a labor dispute. But probably the most interesting interaction between them at this time is one that we don't have a complete record of, because Roosevelt is recorded as having told Frances that the nicest thing anybody said to him upon taking the presidency came from Grover Cleveland. We don't know what was said, but Roosevelt records it as being the equivalent of a senior putting his hand over a freshman's shoulder, telling him everything's going to be all right. It's not the sort of sentimentality that we normally associate with Grover Cleveland, but these men had a relationship running back years, running over many different venues. And you saw that in the moments when Roosevelt became president.
Troy's book is a gift because Cleveland did not write memoir, did not write an autobiography. Why not, Troy? Can we puzzle it together?
Well, yeah, because he left us some testimony as to why. He was asked about this in his post-presidency, and his initial reaction for the first few years was, I don't think anybody wants to hear from me. I don't know that I have anything to say. He eventually gets more and more tempted by it, and we come really close, actually, to an oral history project, which would have doubled as one. And then the offer falls through, and Cleveland, because he's not driven by the sort of megalomania that we sort of associate with these modern politicians, says to his friends, well, it's probably fine. He said, my autobiography is written on the hearts of my friends and my family, and they can look at it whenever they want. It's a sweet sentiment, and it tells you something about the fundamental humility of the man. But no question that it has been damaging to him in terms of what we would call presidential legacy, a term that would be entirely foreign to him. But he did not have that eye that modern politicians often have on the furthest horizon. What will people think long after I'm gone? I'm not sure that he would have cared if you had asked him.
Several children are born to them in Princeton, and they lose Ruth, which breaks his heart. You've mentioned it earlier. And I want to make note, if you visit Cleveland's grave in Princeton, he's buried next to Ruth. very significant to him. Francis will remarry, but I want to stay after the president's death some years later. I want to stay with what you've achieved in piecing this together, because Cleveland seems to be distributed widely, the memoirs of Cleveland. And it's not easy to ascertain all of these resources. There has been a missing piece of American presidential history. Do we know why, Troy? All these years later, it's easy to find how Cleveland was anticipating the great policies of the 20th century.
Do we know
why he's been overlooked?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I think one is the one that I just mentioned, because Cleveland, of not having written a memoir, because Cleveland, if you look in the decades immediately after his presidency, when there are still people living with the memory of a Grover Cleveland administration, he actually ranks quite highly in the 40s in the Schlesinger poll. He's number 8 all time. He's between John Adams and Teddy Roosevelt. But that dies off with that same generation who lived through it. That's point one. But point two, and this is one of the reasons that I wanted to write this book, this era that he inhabited is extremely foreign to us, more foreign than earlier ones. Most Americans understand the stakes around the Civil War. They understand the stakes around the founding era. But think about the issues we've just talked about: bimetallism, military pensions, tariffs, civil service reform. These all seem so antique. And so part of the rationale behind this book was not only to introduce people to Grover Cleveland, maybe for the first time, but to introduce them to the issues of this era and what they mean, how they analogize to the modern context. Because let's be honest, most people, when you're a high school student, for instance, you may get 2 days on this era in American history. And so much of it is so alien that it requires a little bit more analysis to really understand how it fits together in the American story and how figures like Grover Cleveland fit in to the American story.
He was understood as incorruptible. Many quotations at length by Grover Cleveland writing about bills he agrees with or positions he will or will not take. He evidences that he'd only ever had offices where he could determine by himself without committee or consultation what is going to happen. And sometimes it was rejected by his legislature or the aldermen or the councils he was dealing with. Sometimes it was embraced. But he's not a man who learned to compromise early, which is what he would have if he'd risen through the ranks, say, as a member of Congress, or even before that as a member of the Assembly in Albany. And so I don't know whether we could have a model like Grover Cleveland anymore. He seems quite out of time to me at times, Troy. He's not thinking ahead about how politically you achieve difficult stories by going with small bites, not big bites.
I think that's right. He just seems like a sort of cryptid. He doesn't fit into the way that we think about politics now. And I think you're quite right to suggest that he... Not only did he not have any legislative experience, hard to imagine him having any legislative experience, right? I mean, you see this occasionally with former governors who go into the Senate, and so many of them are so frustrated with it that they leave after a single term, because there's just a different sensibility behind it. And Cleveland is a guy who has to be sort of driving the bus. And he says this in his retirement, that one of the things he does miss about office is the intellectual exertion, the feeling that he was doing something and to be laboring for the country as a whole. That is really sort of fundamental to his character.
Troy, your thoughts now about Cleveland as a president. Was he a success?
I say in the book that he was a great president, which doesn't necessarily mean he had a great presidency. And what I mean by that is a lot of his policy accomplishments were sort of half accomplishments. And on a lot of fronts, he failed. But precisely the thing that you identified, that sense of firmness, of character, of resolve, of incorruptibility, those are things that I think should be a touchstone for any American president. And by that measure, he is certainly a success.
Yes, Grover Cleveland versus the Gilded Age. The book is A Man of Iron, Cleveland Wins, The Turbulent Life and Improbable Presidency of Grover Cleveland. I highly recommend President Cleveland, the 22nd and 24th President of the United States. Troy Senek is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.